After all this, you still...
I still want that gas, yes. And you had better deliver.
Hey, dear listeners. Welcome back to the Greenhouse. I'm joined by friend of the show, and technically you're on payroll as tech contributor. We haven't produced anything yet, but please welcome back to the Greenhouse, Boom Man.
What's up? How's it going?
So this particular episode, we're going to be discussing this is a foundational text. I've been talking about this for a while on the podcast. But it's been a while since I've actually completed the book, and you and I had made it a mutual project to go through this book together and have a couple discussions about it. So we're talking about Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm glad we finally got to kind of break through on this, because I've heard people talk about this book, but I've never actually read the whole thing all the way through. So I'm super glad we finally got that, time to actually do all that.
Yeah, and it's I feel there's a twofold benefit to this book, especially if you're trying to gain a further leftist conscience, or you're just trying to be better read or better informed about things that are going on, or, and this is the second level I was trying to mention, is if you feel the concept of getting into reading nonfiction or reading up on theory and reading up on history is hard, this is actually a foundational text to breaking that fear, if that makes sense.
No, yeah, absolutely. And when we first talked about this book, I in my head I didn't realize that it was a people's history, So first of all, yeah, this was kind of new for me reading nonfiction text, because, honestly, I haven't really had the time to read a lot or too much before I really got into this whole reading thing with this book and with other pieces of text. And the staying informed is really nice too, because when I first got this book, I thought it was just a general history book, even though it was called The People's History. I really did think it was just going to be okay, this is what happened at this time, this is what happened at this time. But it really does paint a really good picture, from the side of the oppressed, about what was actually going on and what was relevant in that time period, which is really nice.
And I think this was both a good exercise for both of us, get back into the habit of reading, right? Because I think a lot of people make that hackneyed post of oh, I used to read so much as a kid and now I can't do it as an adult, right? And I kind of feel the only way to deal with that is the only way through the tunnel is through. But what this book did is it finally puts you on a level playing field of if you conceptually understand okay, the game is rigged. There's a lot of myths about American exceptionalism, but you don't have the foundational backdrop to set that up against. It can kind of erode your confidence when you talk about stuff, or when you try to think about stuff deeper. You don't have the intellectual base to draw that on.
Oh, absolutely.
And, yeah, and what Zinn does is he's moving very quickly with this book. It covers probably 1492 up until the War on Terror. That's the scope of the book, yeah. And there's maybe a couple things he misses, I'd say, that, and it's really just nitpicking on my part if he missed anything. But you can kind of see, one, your suspicions about the system kind of confirmed in real time, and also you start to see how it was put into place and who put it into place and to what ends it was meant to be done, right?
Yeah, it's you really start questioning how history was taught to you in school versus how it was actually presented in this book. You really start to think about why specific events, why specific ideas weren't taught in our high school or college history classes, which is interesting. part of me once, when I was reading this book, like kind of learning specifically about some of the labor movements in the 19th century, part of me was like, why wasn't this taught? Why didn't I know about any of this? And it felt like I was almost gaslighting myself because of how I was taught in high school almost. It was like, maybe I'm, you know, thinking conspiratorially, or maybe, you know, I'm just overreacting. And no, but no, this stuff was purposely left out for a reason, you know? And I think that getting into the habit of A, reading new information, which is something I definitely need to do, which is why I guess starting with this book was perfect. And then B, like questioning the official narrative to a certain extent is just also, is really helpful, honestly. And yeah, I feel like a lot of our high school experience, we've just been either lied to or gaslit about events that like still have impact to this day.
Yeah, I mean, let's delve a little deeper into that thread, right? Because it's like, what exactly was that history teaching us?
I mean, I feel like let's be real, the history in high school, like, or the history, even the history in college, honestly, like college right. classes, they teach us essentially to reinforce the status quo, right? That's all it is. At the end of the day, it's like you go to high school so that you can be a productive worker. You go to college so that you can be a super productive specialized worker, and ultimately to enforce a system, to build the system, and to kind of like generate more income and profits for the system, right? So when our versions of history is obviously taught to us in a manner that reinforces what society already thinks, what society already has like a stance on, and it kind of like indoctrinates us to that, right? Which is why history, in my opinion, is taught the way it is, right? History is always taught that Christopher Columbus was such a great guy, which we have just now recently, like, we knew his atrocities, right? Like, America as a whole knew of his atrocities. But when we were kids, we were taught that he was just a great explorer, and he discovered America, and the Thanksgiving dinner happened, like, a couple, you know, years, centuries later, and that's how America got here. Like, no, it was, like, genocidal and terrifying. And oftentimes, I hear a lot of, like, excuses for our education system, like, you know, you can't teach kids about genocide, but, like, we should really be teaching, like, when it comes to, like, atrocities in history, there has to be a time in which they get taught. So maybe not elementary kids, but, like, that's why I keep, like, kind of focusing on high school, because, like, that's when you learn about a lot of atrocities, that's when you learn about, like, crazy stuff going down, like the Holocaust, like, you know, like the bad stuff. Christopher Columbus never shows up in those, like, in high school, no one ever talks about that. No one ever talks about how, you know, Abraham Lincoln really didn't care that much about slavery and about how he only did it to keep the Union together, or about how the U.S. government literally opened fire on striking workers, you know? Like,
yeah.
No, we don't talk about the atrocities of the U.S. We talk about the atrocities of other countries and other people in, like, other places super far away and culturally disconnected. But when it's time to, like, the whole purpose of high school is to just prepare you to work for your society. So I think it's very obvious that they would teach us in that specific way so that we can just be robots and, like, just profit machines for that society. And you can't teach ideas that would ultimately go against the status quo.
Yeah, I think, like, what you kind of elucidated there is, like, the existing way history pedagogy works right now at like the primary level, but then just as a whole, right? It's not emancipatory, nor is it explanatory in any way, right? And like that old like expression of like, oh, history is written by the victors, you know. That is the version of history we're referring to. This is the victor's history that's being mentioned here. But I think it leaves people, like, feeling empty inside, especially because it is, like, so narrative-driven, and it's a particular narrative that gets sold, right? So I always, like, growing up, like, I always thought history was a boring discipline, because it's like being read a story verbatim and then like being tested on how well you can regurgitate it. When in reality, you know, it's supposed to be about inquiry. It's supposed to be about like critical examination, and it is supposed to be about like trying to answer like, okay, what are the roots of these things we can observe today? And I think like once you start to have a left-wing critique of the society you live in, that's where your understanding of history, and especially like in a, you know, in a dialectical materialist context, understanding history at the confluence of like power and economic structures that like enforce that power, as well as like the social dynamics of those societies. If you don't understand how that works, it's like, it's disenfranchising in a way.
Yeah, I feel like when you're looking at history, you need to have like some ability to analyze. Like, I think you're entirely right. I think you need to have some ability to analyze, and I think the reason why history sucks so much when we were kids is because the analysis was done for us. You know, like and it obviously had a specific narrative. It obviously had a specific like goal or idea that it was trying to make us reach already. It was already like done. So we were just taught like, don't question things. Don't even think about it. This is what happened. Memorize it. You know, and that's kind of it. When you're entirely right, you need to have some way to like analyze history. Yeah, no, you're right.
And I think like I talk a lot about like American civic religion, right? And that basically is referring to I think Professor Robert Bella's thesis on like a kind of like reverence for America's like civic institutions and a certain version of its history that particularly politically engaged people will adhere to, right? And if you think about like that model of civic religion in American society, right, where it's like, okay, the system works and it was designed by these wise men we call the founding fathers, blah blah blah, and the president is like our national father if you think about it, but we voted for him so it's fair, blah blah blah, you know, the way we treat civics and history education then in that model is, it's basically like it's Sunday school.
Wow, I hate the fact that you said that, and I hate the fact that there's so many good correlations to that. I hate that.
Right, and it's like at some level, like there is just a degree of like, okay, you're gonna have to memorize shit. You're gonna have to be able to like explain sequential events. That's any discipline. Like, I'm not gonna say all learning is fun and empowering and blah 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 blah. Like, some of it is, it has to be boring by design. But at the same time, like, I think it wasn't until high school for me, actually, that I was exposed to this idea of, like, history as, like, a study of inquiry. And I got very lucky, and I got a chance to take AP U.S. History in high school. And this was before the culture war had really like tried to eviscerate the curriculum on it. I don't know if like the curriculum on it is even like as good as it was, at least when I engaged it, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that like it's, you know, oh, like I was trained dialectically in A Push. No, that's not what I'm saying. Like, it was still like gearing people towards like a liberal understanding of history, right? But
right.
I was very lucky to like have a teacher in high school who like was willing to talk about colonial depredation, who was willing to talk about, you know, America's involvement in the Philippines, sharecropping, the different contradictions in like the civil rights movements, and like how there were attempts to manage it in a direction that was favorable to the existing order, you know, stuff like that. The fact that like I had a teacher who didn't shy away from talking about figures like John Brown, you know, there's an enlightening aspect to history education that a good teacher can provide to a student. And I'm very lucky to have gotten that. I credit like my push leftward to that experience, but it's not one that everyone gets, you know what I mean? And I don't even know if my teacher even intended for that, because they weren't really like ideologically inclined towards the left, like if I think about it, right? But to have like a pedagogical directive on like, hey, you're going to learn about inquiry and like you should be critical about these events in America's past.
That's awesome, because right. I had the exact opposite experience, right? Like my experience was, because like I was definitely more like math and science oriented, and so like my history classes were more of like, literally, here's what happened. Like even when we touched on like the Cold War,
mm-hmm.
and like, you know, you can't talk about communism when you talk about the Cold War, right? That was like the right. biggest like pissing match between the two global powers. And like, even when we talked about communism, it was just communism bad and capitalism good because we won. And that's literally as far as it really got. Like there was no questioning anything. So I really am jealous of your experience. I guess I wasn't then, because, you know, math and science, to me, history wasn't that important at that time. I wasn't too like politically oriented in any, you know, meaningful way. I knew being poor sucked, and that's kind of it. So when it came down to it, I didn't really care that much about history, and I kind of held on to that idea even up until college. I had to take like a very small like U.S. kind of history-esque class in college, which kind of just hit on the same things, because it was a class
mm-hmm.
for engineers and we don't care about history at all. So it wasn't really, it really, this book was a crazy introduction on so many like concepts and ideas in history. Like I did not realize how much I didn't know happened in the 19th century. Like I it was, reading those chapters were,
it's a cultural blank space even. Like,
yeah,
there's no, like, movies, like, about it. There's no like popular understanding of it. And when there is like pop celebrations of history, right? Like most people only talk about like the War of Independence, the Civil War, and like World War II, if anything.
Yeah, and like even when it does show up in pop culture, it's you can tell it's just the aesthetic. It's literally just like the steampunk, steam engine, pipes everywhere, industrial-esque aesthetic, and that's it.
But not like the massive like class divides.
Exactly.
That characterized it. Exactly.
And it's like such a shame, honestly, because like I feel like one of my favorite sections in this book was talking about like the labor struggles, the labor struggles in the 18th century, man. It's crazy. Or 19th century, sorry.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I guess, I don't know. I'm trying to figure out like what's the best point in the outline, because I mentioned this on the last episode, but like every time I write an outline for one of these, like it just dismantles itself in like the first 5 minutes.
It wouldn't be a greenhouse gaslighting production if we don't jump around.
Oh my God. I got to update the greenhouse gaslighting bingo. And like one of the spaces has to be like, well, there goes the outline. So I guess like for our approach to reading this, we were kind of doing this like a mini reading group, right? It was just the two of us. We were basically going chapter by chapter and then like having a brief discussion like over text about like what we read. And I'm just curious, like, how do you feel about like that social model of reading?
It was amazing. I think that is one of the reasons why we do that in school, because personally, I don't know about you, but I would not have finished this book in the time that we did. Because it was over the course of like months. Like, how long, when do you think we started this?
So we had a couple of setbacks. I'd say like if you're just not counting the setbacks, I'd say we were going like a chapter a week.
Yeah, chapter a week. There was 13 chapters. No, there's more, right?
26. Yeah. So I think
lol. Wow.
Right, right. And it's like we could have moved faster, barring like other things, but like, you know, it's a big text.
Yeah, it's huge, right? And I know personally, like, looking at that, because like when you, because you were the one who first suggested it, right? I initially saw that, looked at how many chapters there were, and was instantly demotivated, not gonna lie. And it wasn't until like we both started bouncing off of each other, both had the idea of like going a chapter a week, like being holding each other accountable, having this like you said, this social like paradigm on how on reading the book and understanding the information. Like, that was probably a key pivotal thing that helped me keep going. Because there were times where, especially, like, even when it comes down to just, like, your own, like, pure emotions and not even, like, the information of the text. Like, reading about the atrocities of slavery, I had to just put the book down. I just did. Like, it went to detail. And, like, some of the stuff that was happening was literally that upsetting where I just mm-hmm. didn't even want to keep going. And if I didn't have someone else there to sit down and go, okay, that's next chapter next week, I don't know how far I would have gotten. So not only do I think it was helpful for me, but I really do think more people should like continue doing this. I think we should like, book clubs are awesome. I thought they were for nerds, but hey, it's pretty cool.
Especially like in left-wing spaces, like doing like reading groups or like reading with a group, right?
Yeah,
especially like when people complain about like, school took all the fun out of reading for me, and ever since I graduated, I can't read anymore. Putting it back in this context, like, actually, like, reminds you of the fact that, like, the problem wasn't reading in group settings or, like, sharing your experiences reading. The problem was, like, your objective in the educational system was not to learn something or to, like, bounce ideas, right? And I think like I've been in other reading groups before, and some of the texts we've read, right? You know, you read the chapters, you might find it like enlightening or elucidating, and you share your, you know, your thoughts with people. And then people with a completely different perspective will shine a light on something that you didn't even notice, and you're like, oh my God, I would never notice that without you. Or they might have had like similar experiences and you don't know if anyone else has. And they share that, and it's vindicating. You know what I mean? So I think like bringing the reading group back, like 2023, we bring in reading groups back.
Oh, we got to
get your friends, read Capital, Pedagogy of the Oppressed. There's probably a whole syllabus of books we can, you know, prescribe, right? But I think like definitely like, yeah, the practice of reading in a group, kind of divorced from that grade school setting of like deadlines and homework, and keeping it purely in the context of like really learning something and sharing those insights with like-minded people. It's fun, man. It's fun.
Yeah, and like it's so important to do, right? Because there's so much information out there. There's so much propaganda. There's so much like liberal co-opting of like leftist ideas. There's some things that you just need to know if you want to like sit down and be serious about, like, I don't want to say serious, but kind of serious about like leftism and leftist ideas, because like it's just important to do. Like you want to be able to like explain your ideas, you want to be able to defend your ideas, and you literally cannot do that if you don't have like the base information, right? So right. And it's leftism. There's so much infighting, and there's so many different ideas if you just look at that alone, you know. And there's so many different flavors. It's like you need to, it's like it's almost like you're forced to pick one as your personality when you shouldn't. Like, that's not a thing that you should do,
right?
But like it would make sense to go around and to like shop around, look at different ideas, read things, read different ideas, have different perspectives, talk to different people. And you can't do that if you don't have that base understanding.
Exactly. And like, and that's really the purpose of dialectics, right? Is like you're enriching things as you bounce them off of people.
Yeah. And you got,
yeah. It's enriched by that process.
Yeah, man. 2023, it's a hot reading summer, you know?
Hot reading summer, hot reading winter. I mean, And also, like, the other thing, too, like, this is, like, an off point, but, like, I was always scared of, like, audiobooks. Because, like, for whatever reason, I always felt like it was cheating to do it. And, like, you know, there maybe it is, like, up to, like, individual preference. And also, like, if you feel like you're not retaining enough of it in an audiobook, that is a legit concern. But, you know, if you're like, oh, I don't know if, like, I have this time, like sit down and read something. Okay, pick up the audiobook then. There's no shame in that.
Yeah, like, because that was my first thought. It was like, should I buy this book versus should I get it as an audiobook? And I know for a fact, for me, audiobooks are more convenient, but retaining information would be harder. So it would save time, but I'd probably have to re-listen to a lot of it, which could be annoying. But ultimately, I think the point here isn't to test how well I can read, mm-hmm. right? The point here is to retain the information. So right. If I were to listen to the audiobook versus reading the book versus, fuck it, like, listening to a song that has all the words in it, you know, I don't think the medium really matters. I think what matters more is you getting that information down, you know? And I feel like, I don't want to say reading is bad, right? Because that's, you know, I don't want to be that guy. But there are so many people who put such a big emphasis on you have to pick up a book and you have to turn the pages. It's like, you have to get the information, right? That's all that really matters here. Get the information. So I think
like physical mediums do have value. And I think like you should break out of the digital mold at times. But like, if you're struggling with it, like in terms of like the time commitment, that's all I'm saying is like, hey, don't feel ashamed if you got to pick up the audiobook, you know?
Exactly. And I did have the idea that like the audiobook is cheating, but like, it's not. As long as you get the information and, you know, you're retaining it in a way that you can like consistently do, fuck it. Who cares if it's cheating? It's working. You know what I mean?
There is one point about audiobooks we should make though, especially as it pertains to this one.
Oh God, I think I know where you're going with this one.
Yeah, I feel like, and this is not on the outline, but I need to mention this. So, so Boom Man did the right thing. Boom Man, John, fuck it. I think you literally came on the show as John so many times, and I don't know if you're going by Boom Man.
Oh no, it's fine. I don't. You know what's funny? When I first started streaming, but I went by Boom Man on Twitch. And I did, like, a little collab with a bunch of, like, other Twitch streamers. And we, like, played a game or whatever. And then after the game, I was just curious and I jumped on her stream. Someone else who I was, like, streaming with. I don't want to say her user here just in case, because I still stream with her sometimes. And she was talking to other people in her chat. And she was like, oh, yeah, I played with this guy that I just met. His name is Boom Man, but he goes by John. And I was like, bro, what? How did you, what? Huh? Huh? What?
They got the wrong version. It's like, no. Boom Man's the screen name.
Right. No. My parents did not give me the name John. Boom Man is on my certificate. Exactly. His
name is Greenhouse Gaslighting, but he goes by Adi.
Exactly.
Anyways.
Yeah, either works.
Okay. So, you did the right thing and at least got something that was read by a professional. Easy to work with, you know, nothing took you out the immersion.
Right.
There were times where, like, I just didn't have time to, like, get through the book, so I figured, let me do, like, an audiobook chapter of it. I didn't want to pay, so I found, like, a couple YouTube channels of people reading the books and stuff. And depending on what you find and depending on the book, that's okay. There's some people who do like good work with it. With this book, it was a bit trickier. So one of the forms was like this weird like lo-fi hip hop read, but the reader was like they would read the text like plain and verbatim, and there was just a way where like they'd read like the N-word with the hard R out loud.
Oh.
And they'd say it, and then I just like it would just hit everything the wrong way. And I'm like, okay, let me try to see if there's something else. And then I found another channel. I'm not gonna name them. This channel, like, would kind of like, you know, would censor some of that out, would like edit like some of the harsher words in case they needed to, kind of shit, but would otherwise like stick to the text as written. However, the person doing this audiobook thought they could do voices and would basically bust out like really bad impressions during like quotes. So anytime like it's like a Southern planter talking, he busts out like the Looney Tunes like Foghorn Leghorn voice.
That's amazing.
I do declare. And then like a New York machinist that he would just bust out like the "Hey, I'm unionizing here," like kind of voice. And then it just, there was a really bad moment where, do you remember the moment with Sacco and Vanzetti? They were the two Italian anarchists, and
they got sentenced.
So there's a letter I think like Vanzetti wrote to his son, and the content of the letter is like really stirring. It's like, you know, they're gonna execute me, but never give up on human beings. Always fight for the oppressed.
Right.
You know, like have faith in people and like fight against injustice. Very, very touching, and it's like, and it's very serious. But this, like, this person, like, did the Mario and Luigi voice for the letter, and I was just like, oh God.
It's incredible. I mean, in the worst way, but it's incredible.
It's incredible that someone like thought they could do it, and they thought like they really did something with it. But then the worst moment was like, I get to the chapter on civil rights, and he starts quoting MLK, but he starts like doing this like MLK voice as like a nerdy white guy. And like I took my headphones out, I turned the shit off, and I was at the gym, like I was trying to like listen to it during cardio. As soon as I heard it, I stopped, I shut the whole shit down and went home. I'm like, I can't do this.
I mean, that's so crazy. Like, I feel like if you're gonna read a book, you have to do it justice. So I understand like maybe doing voices, but you have to be good at it. You know what I mean? You can't just throw on a Mario and Luigi accent when you're trying to talk
and
about.
It's a like, serious scene. It's right? A really serious scene, and you're just like, literally, like the Luigi voice was like, "Oh, never give up on the people." I'm like, "Oh my God, you're gonna do this?" Anyways.
Oh man.
Oh God.
The one downside of audiobooks, I gotta say. But I mean, luckily, I sold my soul and went to Amazon. Oh no. And you know, at least I had like a professional reader. It wasn't too bad on my end. But I do think it is kind of funny in the worst way of people like taking materials and doing a terrible job. Because like the whole point of an audiobook is to just read it and honestly just make sure you get the point across. And they didn't need to do all that, you know?
Oh God, no. No. Because it's, again, like I think this was a diversion, but like I think like the thing about Howard Zinn's writing style and prose is it's refreshingly light. And it's very serious, but it doesn't take itself with like an unnecessary degree of self-importance. Okay. Do you know what I mean? Like Zinn is very focused on like just dismantling the mythology. So he lets his work like rest on its laurels. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I understand.
Like he's cutting cloth with a very good knife. It's very smooth and it's very easy to read. And generally like with work like that, you can kind of just let it work for itself. I don't know why this guy felt the need to embellish the voices and whatever, but that's a separate point.
Yeah.
But yeah, so like overall, like what's the over under on the book? Like what did you think of like Zinn's approach to it?
I loved it. Like hearing about history coming from someone who shares a very similar ideology as me is awesome because it's something it's so fresh. It's something I've never really gotten before, which is why I think I love this so much. I never even like had the concept or the idea of telling history from the oppressed as opposed to the oppressors.
Mm-hmm.
Like that. I don't know why it's something that I needed so much, but it's something I didn't know I needed. So I loved going into this book. I loved reading it. Even when we were talking about horrible atrocities that like made my stomach turn, like what Columbus did to those natives.
Right.
Even hearing about how like, you know, the poor indentured white servants would try to unite with the, you know, the black slaves or and like other oppressed people, and hearing how the upper class would do everything in their power to make sure that didn't happen. It's like hearing these things coming from like not the victor's point of view.
Right.
Just so refreshing and a new perspective. And I definitely love that. The writing style was amazing. It like, dare I say, compelling at times, which is why like I love this book so much, because me, I was never good at history. Like I said, much more math and science oriented. And like this made me excited about history. I remember like going to bed, still thinking about the book, like yapping off to my wife about like the chapter we were on, when I know she didn't know everything, but like I'm just sitting here excitedly telling her everything. It's amazing. It's like a new feeling. And I think that's in part due to the perspective of the history that we were being taught. I think that was in part to Zinn's writing style and critique. I love that. And yeah, I think that was it. That was kind of my highs and lows. Like the book was amazing. And I'm down to, you know, look more into Zinn and look into more of his work.
Yeah, I got introduced to like his work through another piece, actually. Like there was a graphic novel published as like an addendum to this text sometime in the 2000s. I think it was called A People's History of American Empire. And it's a bit of like an anthology series, and they cover like a couple like unique instances of like atrocities in the American Empire and whatnot. I can't recall each one, unfortunately, but he wrote like the script for it, and some of the comics is also just like him delivering a lecture superimposed over like the events he's describing. So that was like a cool one, but I don't know like if that counts necessarily as like, you know, one of his more serious works.
Fair.
But I think like when people talk Zinn, this is the text they're always pointing at.
That's true. I've heard of Zinn and I've heard of this book, but I never really dove into it. So I'm going to look up that comic. That's going to be interesting to read.
Yeah. Overall, what do you think was your favorite segment of the book?
My favorite segment? Definitely, what was the chapter called? The one that was specifically focused on the labor struggles in the 19th century. I know I keep bringing that up. That's one of my favorites.
Let's see, I got my copy here right in front of me.
I think it was called Socialism, a New Challenge or something like that.
It was called The Socialist Challenge. That was there one of go. The good, that was a really good chapter. That was chapter 13.
Yes. I love that so much. I loved hearing about different labor movements that were going on. It kind of sucked hearing about how oftentimes they were crushed. But it's important to know, you know, that information is crazy important to know. And there was so much that was going on in that time period that
reading that chapter too when there was like the plan to have a rail strike last
exactly
year, right?
Yeah, so it was like even then it was like
under similar conditions. It was crazy.
Yeah, and then just like a lot of the labor movements, the rail strike was absolutely destroyed by liberals. So
I think I'm trying to figure out which chapter was my favorite. I mean, because there were a lot of good ones. I'd say like the Socialist Challenge was one of my favorite ones. I think Or Does It Explode also was pretty good.
Ooh, yeah.
I think 20 and 21, so the 70s under control, ? And Carter, Reagan, Bush, the bipartisan consensus. I think if you're trying to understand like the gap between like, okay, there were these massive waves of like agitation against this economic order in the United States. What happened to that momentum? Like that's where Zin really goes in on like what went into dispelling it.
Yeah, and that's super interesting to know, because like if you look at the 60s, that time period was full of rebellion, full of like resistance and protests and everything. And then, you know, 20 years later, it's all fizzled out. And I feel like answering that question as to why or how that could have happened is super important.
Right, right. And he even goes into like a bit of coverage of like Watergate. He talks about things like the Trilateral Commission, and he talks about like the kind of like development of the modern like capitalist order, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe it's a bit mainstream, or maybe it's a bit like limited in its scope. But I think, like, you know, when a lot of people talk about capitalism, or they talk about like the elite, it always gets talked about as this like shifting, formless, like black hole, right?
Yeah.
But to have like some of the stakeholders and players like named, you start to then see like, okay, these are the incentives they were trying to chase, and so on.
Yeah, and I think that like I love how he, in the very beginning, in the very early on, when America was being founded and created, the way he talks about the divide between the upper, like the rich capitalist class and the working class, and like the reason for the wars were to like maybe like make sure to give the poor class like an existential threat to be afraid of, like those types of like themes and motifs that are like that happened back then, and the way he talks about them and his nuance, it's so cool, because you can look at it in today's time period and go, oh, that's still happening now, you know, like his lens on how he views history is so relatable. And I don't know if it's because, you know, America is a broken record that's doing the same thing over and over again, or because of the way it's being taught, but either way, it's an interesting way to, it almost teaches you, it almost gives you the ability to analyze history on your own, while at the same time retaining that information.
Right, and I think like what Zin's fundamental thesis is really is like, he basically sets up that like whatever pretenses you have about America, erase them and understand that like what it is it's a bourgeois project. It was set up by like either merchant classes or landholding classes, to best protect their interests. It wasn't really a liberationary project for anyone but them. And it creates like a gap between them and the people they exploit. And that exploitation has been papered over in every cycle of its various incarnations, right? And that's basically like each chapter he talks about how like, well, these are the people who benefited, this is who they exploited, and any mention of it gets swept under the rug or gets buried, or the dissent is crushed in some way. But he's very optimistic in his retelling, in a way that I think like we do need to pay attention to, because it's very easy to be like, oh, it was crushed and it's never going to come back. And he says, no, it's more like people find a way to rise up from it. And I think that optimism is critical to maintain. But at the same time, too, it doesn't excuse the order and the people that maintain it.
No, 100%. And
because that's basically what this is like, this is a protection racket for that class.
Wow. Yeah, no, you're entirely right. And I want to talk more about the point you made about like being optimistic. And like, I just want to talk about that because that's so important. Even when I was reading this book, there were times where I was like, wow, I hate this country and it's never going to get any better. And there's never going to be a strong enough labor movement to allow the working class to, you know, reach for better. And it's just hopeless, right? But at the same time, it's like, if you look at it like that, you're going to have like this depressive mode, and it's going to make the learning less fun, and it's going to make your impact less helpful, right?
But well, it's also, like Zinn is also saying, like, it's ahistorical to look at it that way.
Exactly, yeah. That's the important part. It's like, first of all, you can't just look at the failures. You need to look at how we have risen from that, you know? And you can't only look at the downsides and look at the failures without also, like, you said it perfectly. It's ahistorical. You need to be able to look at the entire picture and go from there. And I feel like a lot of pessimism comes from not looking at the entire picture.
Exactly. So I'm trying to think, like, where do we go next from this? So I think we talked about favorite chapters. We talked about favorite segments. What segment were you most shocked by?
Oh, segment I was most shocked by. This is going to sound like, this might make me sound kind of dumb, but the segment I was the most shocked by was the very beginning. Learning about exactly what Columbus did. And the reason why I was really shocked by it, like, as an adult, you eventually learn Columbus was bad. You learn that he probably did way more genocidally things than is currently mentioned. And, you know, you just come to understand that. But I never really sat down and had to learn what exactly or how those atrocities were committed or, like, how many Native Americans there were before and after Columbus. Like, I never sat down and actually learned all that. So I guess learning about the, like, how he worked those people to the bone, how, like, the rampant, like, starvation, the,
I mean, like, cutting off people's ears. Like, American history begins not with this historic voyage, with this heroic exploration. It starts with the enslavement and genocide of the Taino people.
Exactly. And that's, it was very shocking for me. Like, I never really sat down and learned all of that. So learning it now was like, it was intense.
I'd say there's a lot of attention given to these really dark stories. And I'd say, like, there's a lot of competing, like, which one was, like, the most shocking. I'd say the same chapters I mentioned, when Zinn talks about the cover-up in Cambodia. Like, it's something, like, I kind of knew about, but, like, reading about it in this level of detail, I'm like, oh, that's what we did. And the fact that, like, there was a whole bombing campaign just kept out of view of the public, you know?
Yeah, I think that was a big one. Another crazy one that I thought was very interesting was our involvement in the Philippines.
Right.
I never even knew. I knew, like, obviously we were involved, but again, I never knew the extent. I never knew, you know, what, like, how the Philippines were quote unquote liberated from Spain. Like, there's so much of that I just had no idea about.
Yeah, and, like, that history is very poorly understood, and, like, there's people who I unironically probably parrot this idea that Cuba and the Philippines were liberated from Spain, right? But
yeah.
No, it was a ploy to expand American markets and maintain our own colonies, you know, one in Asia and one in Latin America. And I'd say even around the same time, right? Like, I'm not necessarily sure if it was the same period, but there's also, like, what, gunboat diplomacy in Japan. I think the United States was also, like, trying to push markets in China as well.
I loved hearing about the one of my favorite parts, specifically about the Philippines, was hearing about the president's reaction. Where I forget which president, but he was essentially
It was McKinley.
Yeah, pondering what to do with the Philippines.
Oh God, no! So that is one of the stories in the graphic novel, and it's the same text verbatim in this book. But the segment is so disturbing, right? Where it's like McKinley dresses up his naked imperial ambitions in like Protestant piety, basically.
Yeah, dude, that's crazy. Like reading about how he was like, oh, so he told his advisors, he prayed and prayed and prayed to ask God what he was supposed to do with the Philippines, and he decided he was gonna hold on to the Philippines, and God told him. And the very next sentence was something along the lines of the Philippines, or God didn't tell it to the Philippines, so they fought back. And I love that. That was definitely one of my favorite passages.
Man, I'm gonna start using that excuse. Man, Adi, why didn't you drop the new episode, man? God told me not to do it.
Exactly.
Dude, why are the quality of episodes so bad, man? God told me not to stop.
God told me, bro. Yeah. What can I do?
God's plan.
God's plan. No. That's awesome.
Oh God. I think what pervasive myth of American history was like most violently wiped from you from reading this?
Pervasive history or pervasive myth. I think it's hard to pick one. You know what I mean? Pretty much all of it. It's like American exceptionalism, bullshit. American dream, bullshit. Like, if you want to talk about specific events in history, you can talk about like the civil rights movement, and how, you know, the United States government treated that. Because one of the things that really bothered me when we were reading about the chapter on the 60s was that when you think about the civil rights movement and you think about how you were taught in high school, that was one of the biggest myths, right? Because it's like, right, when you learn about it in high school, you think, oh, you know, MLK, you think Malcolm X, you think all these great people, and they fought against not the American system, but against white racists. And no one ever takes responsibility to how those white racists got there. And when all actuality, they were fighting against, like, they were fighting against racism, don't get me wrong, but they were also fighting against the American system. They were fighting against capitalism. They were fighting against imperialism. And it was it's really interesting to see that, like, when you learn about it from history, you really do think all of America was on board except for those crazy racists, when that just obviously was not the case, you know?
Yeah, and I think like that's really the beauty of Zinn's style, is to expose, like, no, this is not a bug, this is a feature of the system.
Yeah. What do you think your greatest dispelled myth was?
I probably, if I gotta go with one, I'd probably go with this idea that in the same chapter of the 70s under control, right? This idea that like the system of the United States is incorruptible in some way, or that it's democratically accountable. It's something that I already was like not sure of, or like it was already something I didn't believe,
right?
Like prior to reading this, like all the way through. But at the same time, like, and this is like a very vanilla coverage of those events, right? Like people get very deep, especially in like the parapolitics realm, with the coverage of those events. And he's talking mm-hmm. about. He's talking about coups. He's talking about the depredations of the CIA. He's talking about Henry Kissinger. You know, just the rogues gallery that was in the White House and in the just the greater Washington complex at the time, right? This idea that like the U.S. foreign policy is rooted in justice or fairness, or that any steps out of bounds it's taking in the name of anything good.
Right.
Like, that was violently shattered for me. Like, any assumption that this is, like, well-meaning in any way. Like, it was already, like, threadbare in my mind at that point, but, like, at that point I'm like, okay, you don't even have to get too paranoid to admit, like, okay, yeah, these guys are up to no good.
Yeah.
And from the jump, they've never been up to any good.
Yeah, see, that was an interesting myth for me as well. I think I really like you hit that point. One of the things that I always thought, and I don't know if I always thought this or if I was taught this, I don't even remember how I came across this idea, but I remember thinking it. I remember thinking, like, wow, America is so corrupted now. I wonder, like, you know.
They must have had good intentions at the past.
Exactly. Right? It's like America was started on these great intentions. No, it wasn't. No, it was not. America was started by racist, landowning, people-owning assholes, and they created a society that supported rich, white, landowning, people-owning assholes. You know, it's not an accident.
Right, and I think, like, that's literally, like, the liberal versus conservative approach to it is, like, the right wing approach is especially like, you know what, we did those bad things and we should be proud of it. It's good that we do those things, and it's or that, like, you know, we had every justification to do it. And then the liberal version is, okay, it might be bad, but the project is fundamentally pure in some way, so it excuses every bad thing we do. Or like, we have the potential to be better, so you should forgive, like, our worst mistakes for now in the name of the better that is yet to come. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I think, yeah, like, both approaches to obscuring that are insincere, you know?
Yeah, and it's hard to think that obscurity is done on accident, you know?
Exactly, right, because it's like, I think at the end of the day, it depends on your level of investment in the status quo, the institutions as they presently stand. And I've talked about this before on the show, and I guess we can revisit this point, right? But it's like, I think American liberals particularly, like, have a reverence for the institutions. I think when it comes to civic religion, I think they are the more faithful than the Republicans when it comes to, like, the historical figures in a way, right? But their interest in preserving them, whether it's for personal maintenance of power, or whether it's because they sincerely believe there's something inherently good or something worthy to protect in them, or they've been conditioned into, like, being guardians of the status quo, right? It will always bar them from exposing the injustice inherent in the system. Because, again, like, that, and that's what Zinn's saying here, and that's, like, my understanding is more concrete about it now, that, like, it's a bourgeois project. It was never meant to be liberationary. It was never meant to solve contradictions or increase freedom or make things better for the people who toil under it, or the people who have been most viciously exploited by it.
No, I think you're 1,000% correct. I think one of the most important themes that Zinn brings up is the difference between revolution versus reform.
Right. And I wrote a thread about it because of that chapter, the progressive.
Yeah, I saw it and you went off, my guy. That was amazing. I feel like the whole reform versus revolution is another big difference, like what you were mentioning before about big difference between liberals and conservatives and how they view and hold the status quo and how they preserve, you know, American history and have an ahistorical view on that. I think that the idea of, like, reform is kind of like the basis of, like, the liberal thought, and the reason why that is exactly what you said. It's because it was started by rich, like, bad liberals who thought, or who understood that, like, this project was never here for freedom, it was never here to support equality, it was here to maintain their power, it was here to create more power and money and capital. And so when we talk about, like, revolutions and doing actual real change to the status quo, Republicans and Democrats will push back. And I thought that was really interesting because even Zinn mentioned in the later articles when we're talking about more contemporary history, he mentions that a lot of the times the political agendas between Democrats and Republicans are ultimately the exact same. There's not really that big of a difference. The only real difference is, again, progressives will push more for useless reform, useless reform that doesn't really do that much good to anybody or doesn't address the root cause of the problems.
And that's the thing, that reform is one of the ways they paper over the exploitation, right?
Exactly.
And it's not to say that reform is inherently malicious. I think, like, there are people who are well-meaning and they think that reform is the way through. But reform is the way you preserve the current order. And in my thread, like, I was basically pointing out that, like, when you look at the progressive era, right, it was done to control the growing power of labor. It was done to basically, it's basically like, you know, pouring cold water on a fire that's about to rise. It's like, this situation might fall out of our control, and Roosevelt was like, Theodore Roosevelt was of the elites. And there's a statement like he makes to a banker. They quote it in the book where he's like, "Rest assured, I will be most conservative in my approach to this." And basically, like, the reformist, the system choosing reform may imply there's a catch, you know? It's not enough to just seek reform. You have to wonder, why did the system need to be reformed in the first place? And what is it trying to accomplish with said reform?
Yeah, it's like, it doesn't matter. If you constantly need to reform, the problem isn't going to be solved by the next reform. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
you need to, at the end of the day, I think the biggest issue is that the root problem will never be addressed. And that's done on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that a lot of people think that, like, reform is the answer, but, and I feel like you have your opinion on whether or not reform is malicious. I don't know if I can agree with. I feel like non-malicious reform would be a revolution, right?
There you go.
It would be ultimately changing the status quo.
I meant more so, like, for average people, right? Because it's like...
Oh, I see. Okay.
You know what I'm saying? Like, we have this pervasive idea in the culture, right? That, like, trying to disrupt the status quo is impolite at best and, like, inherently, like, misanthropic in some way. You know what I mean? That's like the degree to which, like, you know, there is this, like, background current of reactionary sentiment in America, right? So, and it's like this idea, this fear of, like, oh, I might rock the boat too much. Like, it's the most, like, pervasive feeling.
Yeah, it's like...
It's
like we can fight for equality, but whoa, not too hard now. You know, it's kind of right, like that idea. That's crazy to me. I feel like it's insane that type of reasoning is A, so pervasive, and B, like, the default. You know, like, it's like when you talk about when you find someone and you talk about, like, actual real things you can do to, like, fix a problem that everyone knows is a problem. Right, like decommodifying housing, for example.
Right,
you talk about that, and then people will push back. Even liberals will push back so hard, and it's like, how? Why? Like, what's the problem here?
I mean, the problem staring us in the face now at this point is, like, we've reached the upward floor on, like, who can afford housing. There's literally about to be a point where, like, people cannot afford housing, and you are, like, pushing people into impossible positions.
Yeah, and but like, no one wants to do anything about it.
No one wants to do anything about it. And like, if you dare say, damn, what if we gave people housing? How about we just take the L on it?
Everyone will lose their mind.
It's haram. You can't even say it. You know what?
Yeah. That's just wild to me. I don't know. I feel like the reason why we're like at this point of like, oh, we just can't give poor people houses. Like, it's done on purpose. You know, it's an idea that's been pushed on us. Like, everything needs to be done for a profit. Don't decommodify things. No free healthcare. Like,
and this is what I meant by the term greenhouse gaslighting when I came up with it. Right? It's like,
yeah, go more into that. What do you mean?
Like, so the jokey thing I've always been saying since I started the show is like, it's like, you know, being gaslit in a hot greenhouse and you're just raising the temperature in it, but nothing, like, you don't realize how hot it's getting. It's not a clear metaphor at all. It was really just something like I thought would be a cool name for a podcast, but when I keep saying someone's like, oh, they're gaslit in the greenhouse, this mentality is what I'm referring to, you know?
So that
you've
more like,
you've already imposed this limit on what you deem possible.
The greenhouse is the limit.
Yeah.
That's a really cool metaphor. When you were first talking about it, I thought it was more in line with like a boiling frog, kind of, you know, that metaphor where like you just turn up the temperature a little bit.
That works too.
Either way, that's a great way to think about it, man. And it really is, because it's so true. It's like you sit, we're kind of stuck in this greenhouse, no real way out. This looks like the limit, and slowly the temperature's getting hotter.
Right.
Eventually, something's gonna happen.
Will it be favorable? That's the thing.
I mean, I feel like the only way to make it favorable is to be, you know, is to have some type of impact when it does go down. Yeah. I think that's the big problem. Because if we're going about fixing America through reforms, you don't really have that impact.
No, you don't. And I think that's why you need to highlight the contradiction. And that's really that's really Zinn's thing, is like, he is passionate, he is not necessarily scathing, but like very honest about what he exposes. But he's basically very gently but plainly bringing up contradictions inherent in this present order and our retellings of how this present order came to be, right? Which like, you know, it leads me to my next thing, which is like the resentment that conservatives have for this book. So yeah, you were telling me like offline, like you know, you accidentally found like one of the conservative rebuttals to this book on accident.
And I love it so much. Yeah, I was trying to find this book on audio on Audible, or I don't want to give an ad, but whatever. Trying to find this book on, you know, trying to find the audiobook, and I forgot that the word people was in the title. So I was searching for the book, and I landed on A Patriot's History of the United States.
Oh, God. Ah.
And it is just as bad as you think it is, right? The reviews, hang on, let me see if I can find the reviews right quick.
Oh,
the reviews is, I want you to guess the amount of stars it has. You're going to cry when you realize.
It's got 5 stars, huh?
4.5. 4.5 out of 5.
Man, the dick riding is going off.
It's crazy. But when you actually go on that audiobook site, there are so many comments as to like, wow, this is very biased, or wow, it's a very clear slant to this book. And it is. Out of curiosity, I went on the Wikipedia page. After like stumbling across that, and literally it just talks, the Wikipedia page was like talking about how like they were praising like these, like the very top of the top. They were praising Thomas Jefferson. There's passages about how great all of the presidents were, how Columbus was actually a really cool dude. Like, I'm not making this up. This legitimately, like, it's just, it's so amazing because literally all it is just a reinforcement of what I already learned in high school.
It's interesting that they went back into, like, the great man style of history for that version of the book.
Isn't that, like...
And because yeah, like, Zinn is talking about everyday people's struggles in this shit. And then to do, like, the right-wing version of it, you say, fuck the everyday people, and you go back to these supposed heroes.
Exactly. It shows the United States as, like, this super amazing, like, positive force for the world when we all know that, like, can't be true, right? Like, they're, like, even if... It's so hard to believe. Like, even if you're, like, on such a far-right view... or a far-right, like, ideology, you can look at America and be like, you know, some of the stuff we did was bad. Like, some. You know? But, like, the book makes it seem as if we didn't. And that's, like, it really does seem like that dude, you know what I mean? That like, when we're having a conversation about things like civil rights, like slavery, this book is the personification of that one annoying guy that goes, oh, yeah, but there were white slaves somewhere, too. Not in America, but somewhere. You know, like... This book is the personification of that annoying guy.
It's, I mean, I even saw, like, when I looked up this book on YouTube, like, I would get recommended, like, shit from PragerU. There's, like, this ongoing resentment I've seen of, like, this book where, like, conservatives will talk about how this book ruined, like, an entire generation of Americans. And, like, this is the left-wing Marxist text that's, like, ruining history education. But, like, there is that thread in, I'd say, like, the conservative movement and even, like, some of the intellectual bases of American conservatism, right? Like, there is, like, the school of history that tries to teach the lost cause, for example, right? As if it has any intellectual basis or any, like, actual historical merit. As a theory, right? That, like, oh, the South was fighting for states' rights. And yeah, the states' rights to what?
Exactly. Like, you got to follow it up.
But especially, like, this book, right? Like, I think it's the same, the resentment they have for this book, it's the same thread as, like, I don't know if you followed the controversy on, like, I think it was, like, the state of Texas, this must have started in, like, 2016, and, like, it's been an ongoing culture war battle since, was, like, we are banning AP US history, and we're gonna ban, like, discussions of slavery, we're gonna ban, like, the teaching of, like, certain historical events, like colonialism, all this shit, because, and, like, literally the reason is because it paints America in a negative light.
Oh yeah, brother, can't have that CRT.
Yeah, I mean, it's so facile, right? That's like
you won't
even teach it, and then, like, you could do, like, the real right wing thing of being like, and it was good. you guys are so, like, visibly shaken by, like, the contradiction in your face that you're just like, oh, let's not talk about it.
If you're gonna go for it, commit.
But they won't. They won't do it. And I mean, frankly, I don't think that the other approach of, like, them embracing the depredations is exactly better either. But it's like,
I mean, you know, it might not be better, but it's at least more honest. I feel like, you know, like, pretending that, like, you know, Jim Crow era didn't happen versus, like, owning that shit. I don't know. I don't know which one I'd rather see.
Like, I'd rather see neither. But, like, it's just, it's so facile.
Yeah. Exactly.
And again, like, the APUSH, like, you know, syllabus isn't even pushing people towards, like, socialism or anarchism particularly. It upholds, like, a broadly, like, liberal view that's not really critical of the status quo either, you know what I mean? But it, because it dares, like, inquire certain things, because it dares, like, teach students how to, like, or at least, like, the way I was taught, to think about economic and social conditions of the periods they're studying. You can't have that. You can't have that. I think the bottom line, right, is that right-wing intellectual foundations and ideology and whatever basis they occupy, right, that framework is fundamentally ahistorical. It's fundamentally opposed to that inquiry-based approach we were talking about, right? And it's also like it's incapable of grappling with contradiction. Or if it does grapple with contradiction, its goal is to in fact ratchet it up, and maintain it with exploitation, with oppression, and fundamentally to either like disingenuously or sincerely say that this dysfunction and this injustice is in fact normal and good.
Yeah, and I think that the last thing you said like hit the nail on the head so hard. It's like when you talk to people on the right wing, or when you talk to make a comment online, or pretty much in any space that isn't like overtly leftist, you talk about some of like the atrocities that America has committed. Some of the first things that you will hear coming back is, well, all countries have done something bad. You know, like you hear about, you know, America doing insane shit in the Middle East. You hear about, you know, what's proxy wars, unnecessary proxy wars that America's having. Even if you take that back into history and you start talking about, you know, like atrocities that America has done in the past, it's like, it's so heavily normalized. Like like you said, these contradictions are not being dealt with. We cannot be the land of the free, but also, you know, be really, you know, still profiting off of slavery. It's like the right-wing analysis of history and of our current condition is so fundamentally broken. It doesn't, like, it's more of like a childish, hopeful wish, you know? It's like they treat the current system as if it was Santa Claus and not really asking the question, not really asking the important questions, like, how the hell is he getting to every night on Christmas? You know, how they'll talk about how, oh, we're the greatest, the richest nation ever, but not really, you know, give credit to how that happened,
right,
or what happened to get us here, you know? So yeah, I think that type of, that mode, that analysis on history is so just broken and dangerous and needs to be called out more, which is why I really appreciate this book.
100%. And I think that's what Zinn empowers the reader to do, right? Because I think, a book I'm still working my way through right now is Paulo Freire's Pedagogy of the Oppressed. And he talks about, you know, the problems with education as it currently stands in our liberal capitalist order, and then what he believes, like, if you're going to liberate oppressed peoples, right, through education, how are you supposed to go about it? And he has a term in Portuguese. I don't know how it translates. The word is conscientizado. I can't say it right. But what the term refers to is you're using education as a means to empower the students to examine the world critically for themselves rather than be shaped by it. Whereas, you know, education in the current order is to basically make you a functionary of it. To be a functionary that works within it. To be a functionary that replicates it. So it's kind of like if you really want to think about it, it's like pulling people out of the matrix, right?
Yeah.
And you could even like view it as like, I guess, I don't know if he says it explicitly this way in the book, but the way I interpreted it was like, the goal of education and the goal of like empowering people who have been oppressed with education should be to make them class conscious in a way. And give them the tools to perform analysis, give them the tools to communicate that, and then give the tools to empower people like them. So it's not necessarily just teaching people, it's also then empowering people to then like be the change, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and I think that, yeah, I think you said that perfectly. That's something that's like not happening. I remember watching, sorry, not exactly the most academic source. I was watching some like YouTube video. I forgot what it was some like garbage YouTube short that I have a like an addiction to scrolling through. And it was someone talking about how they believe that the American education system doesn't have a big enough like facts-based approach on teaching history. And like what they meant by that is that like the American, like our educators, they don't teach us enough. They teach us too much, like they almost made it seem like teaching people how to analyze things like history is wrong, as opposed to just teaching us history and teaching us what happened. And I feel like it's like the normative idea is that we need to learn facts, you know, in school. And I feel like that, obviously that's helpful. I'm obviously not going to argue against that, but I really do feel like teaching students how to analyze and teaching students how to learn are like two of the most important things that just do not happen in our current educational system.
100%. And Freire actually like talks about this, and he calls this current model the banking model of education, where basically you're just training students how to be like repositories for things and then regurgitate it out. You know what I mean?
That's interesting. But yeah, no, that's that. So essentially in that metaphor, the students themselves are the banks.
Yeah, they're just information banks at that point.
Damn, that's a really good metaphor and very unfortunate.
Yeah, I still need to work my way through the book, and like, you know, if I got something wrong, as always, feel free to correct me and eviscerate me, but
eviscerate you.
Just the way that Howard Zinn just eviscerated the myth of American exceptionalism in this book, feel free to do the same to me. This is like the most, I don't know, like, yeah, he wrote this book like he had gang beef.
He did, bro. America threw up the wrong sign and he came for him.
Howard Zinn destroys America with facts and
logic. Facts and logic, yes.
If I want to make that the title, but...
You should. Maybe America should have cleaned their room. That way they'd be an alpha male, you know?
Oh, God. Oh, God. I think final take on the book. Cannot recommend it enough. I've been saying for a while now that, like, if you're curious about where to start, start with this book. The point still stands. And it's, you know, I would recommend, like, the same way that me and John went about this, you know, read it socially. Read it with a couple friends. You know, share your observations, share your inputs. Yeah, that'll enrich your experience.
Yeah, definitely taking this on as like a social project as opposed to doing it by myself was obviously one of the best decisions I could have made when I, you know, decided to partake in this. The book is amazing. I definitely do recommend reading it. If I had to kind of like have an influence on like the medium in which the listener reads this book, actually go buy the book. Be very careful where you get your audiobook from. But aside from that, the book is amazing. Great analysis on American history, on our current status quo, on everything we've been taught in high school. Cannot recommend it enough.
100%. Anything else before we start to close out?
No, I think that's it. That's it for me.
Yeah, I think, you know, once again, it was a blast actually reading this book with you. I think, like, another point that I could have brought up when we were talking about the retaining information bit is, like, whether you read it physically or whether you do the audiobook, like, version of going through it, I think an aspect of doing social readings is the discussion somehow, like, helps with the retention of information, for me at least. I don't know if that's everyone's experience, but there's something about having read something and then sharing the observations with someone and then remembering the discussion you had with someone, like, it helps everything, like, digest easier for whatever reason.
Yeah, no, I agree. It, like I said, reading this in a group is just way more helpful. Like, I would have struggled to do this on my own.
Yeah, we're bringing back reading groups, folks. 2020. Bring it back. Greenhouse mindset. Read socially. Let's go.
I love that.
All right. Well, I think that's about everything we had for today. Where can people find you if they want to check out more of what you got?
I stream on Twitch. I stream on Twitch at SSBoomMan, 2 S's, 2 N's. And there I have a couple other, I have a Discord and a Medium page that I need to add something else to soon. I think I might actually add a book report of this book as my next big thing that I'm going to write, but that is it.
All right. I'll have the links to those in the description below. This show is Greenhouse Gaslighting. You can follow us on Twitter at @podgreenhouse, and I'll have our link tree with all our other social links in the description as well. Thanks again for tuning in, dear listeners. We'll see you next time around. Bye-bye.
Of course, when you approach history that way with a point of view, it can be dangerous to your career. And people always wonder why it is that the textbooks repeat the same stories over and over again, or why history is taught the same way, or why the same set of facts are told over again, or why the same things are omitted over and over again. And the very repetition of those omissions, the very repetition of those points of view become persuasive in telling you, well, this must be the truth. If 7, 8, 10 generations of kids learned that Columbus was nothing but a marvelous adventurer and great navigator, a real professional, you know. And if everybody has been taught the same thing for 100 years, it must be true. And if you teach it in a different way, if you teach something that's been taught the same way, or if you write something that's been taught a certain way, and you deviate from that and you start to teach or to write something in a new way, well, that may be dangerous for your career. You may not even consciously think of it that way. You're not consciously selling out. It's just that in a society of economic hierarchy, in a society of economic insecurity, in a society where everybody is in some way insecure, middle class, working class, everybody's in a situation where somebody has power over them, power over their jobs, power over their tenure, power over their promotion, power over their salaries. In every such situation, there's always the thought, or even the unthought but felt need for safety. And safety results in teaching a certain kind of way, writing a certain kind of way, presenting the same set of ideas over and over again. That's safe. But I guess you can put it this way. I never wanted to practice safe history. You know, I remember.